Screen Time with John Fardy.
Thanks to Airtainment, a new era in Irish streaming begins. Discover more at airtainment.com.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Kerry Russell and Rufus Sewell talk to me about the new season of The Diplomat, as well as other cast members David Jesse and Ali Ahn. Plus, we review all the week's new movie releases, including the genre-bending Emilia Perez and the new psychological horror, The Front Room. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, where you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all. I hope you're doing well and enjoying this long bank holiday weekend. Now, I had a very busy few weeks here on News Talk. The London Film Festival was on and there was a load of interviews. Now, this is, you know, going to sound like a terrible name drop, of which I'm infamous for anyway, but I uttered this sentence to someone the other day and it was really the most overblown, self-aggrandizing, pretentious war complaint you've ever heard in your life. In fact, it may be the zenith of first world war complaints that I'm thinking of getting putting up on business cards. But I said to someone the other day, I wasn't able to interview Julianne Moore this Friday because I had to interview Angelina Jolie. That's the truth. Isn't that the most overblown, pretentious, name-dropping, self-aggrandizing war complaint you've ever heard? I think so. The Angelina Jolie interview will come in time. But there you go. That was the kind of week I was having. I share that with you as a little insight. Now, this week in TV, I was obviously watching this.
Since I was 16, playing live has been a deep and lasting part of who I am and how I justify my existence here on Earth. 50 years and the mighty 8th Street Band, baby. But when the world shut down, I made a promise that if we got through this, I'd throw the biggest party I could.
Can't disappoint the fans.
Can't do that.
That is a clip from Road Diary, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. Regular listeners will know I'm a massive Bruce fan, a devotee, you might even say. And this is landing on Disney Plus from the 25th of October, this Friday. Road Diary, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, as I said. And what it is, you got an insight from the clip there. Springsteen was on the road, still is actually, 23-24 tour. Hadn't been out on the road on the E Street Band for 6 years. COVID got in the way. They had plans and then obviously that didn't happen. And as you heard there, he wanted to have one hell of a concert series. And he certainly did. And I was at two of them. And they were great, as they always are. But what this documentary does is basically detail him and the band and their long, long time on the road. And it charts very entertainingly the early days where the E Street Band members are sleeping in vans and on top of each other and all that kind of stuff. And yet it has him backstage and on stage on the current tour, giving it socks, it has to be said, and there is a renewed vigor to the already kind of high octane E Street performances. But because of their long break off the road, they really are bursting to get going. And the shows are quite emotional because Springsteen's into his 70s now. He's lost some people along the way, some band members as well, most notably Clarence Clemons, the well-known saxophonist, his nephew. Jake now plays with the band. But the shows are quite emotional as well as high entertainment as well. So for a Bruce fan, this is manna from heaven. Here's the thing. I'm not sure if you're not a Bruce fan, you're going to marvel at it because this is, I think, one for the fans. Now, it's a great one for the fans and I really enjoyed it and I will probably watch it again in the next few hours. But it's not a great music documentary in the way that, like, some kind of monster, the Metallica one is. Or there's a great documentary called Searching for Sugar Man from a few years ago, all about Rodriguez, that the musician. In that, those are documentaries that if you have no interest in the musician in question, you will still be fascinated by the story it tells. I'm not sure if Road Diary is one of those. And, you know, it gives me no pleasure to say that as a Bruce devotee, but it's a straight ahead concert documentary about a concert and a life on the road, which is very entertaining for Bruce fans. But I'm not sure outside of that if it will blow you away. But look, why don't you watch it and come back to me? It is on Disney Plus from the 25th of October. If you want to get in touch with me and disagree wildly, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Now, let's go here.
Why do you believe her?
Maybe I don't. I just like the idea of finding out one way or the other.
Hey, maybe you tell me what the is actually going on. The part you left out.
Stop it.
Maybe it's okay for me to know.
I didn't do this to you when you kept things in the vault.
Why did you never ask me?
Because I trusted you.
I don't trust you. I don't. Do you trust you?
Is this the part of the conversation where you get mean because you're not getting what you want?
It's not mean. I love you, but this is based on something other than trust. That can't be news to you.
I need to eat something. You're making my head hurt.
Yes, now that was the great Kerry Russell opposite Rufus Sewell. In the new season of The Diplomat, season 2, which lands next week on Netflix on the 31st of October, Thursday. A lot of interest in this show because the first season was great TV. The aforementioned Kerry Russell plays Kate Wyler, the US equivalent of an experienced civil servant who's kind of bounced into the role of becoming the new ambassador to the UK in series 1. This is in the wake of a British aircraft carrier being attacked in the Middle East, causing fatalities and inflaming all sorts of tensions between the UK and the US and Iran, who's suspected of carrying out the attack. And she's this, I suppose, fish out of water American diplomat who kind of doesn't want to be there, is reluctantly there, and yet is pretty good at the job in terms of, you know, espionage and politicaling, if that's the correct word. She also has to contend with her husband, Hal, played by Rufus Sewell, who was a former diplomat himself and a career diplomat, I suppose, and a former ambassador, I should say. And a charismatic guy who kind of thrives on the attention of her job and his former job and is a bit of a player in every sense of the phrase. And he's arrogant, yet charming. And they have a really strange relationship where they seem to be constantly on the verge of breaking up. Series 1, Emmy nominated, really popular. It was great, entertaining, kind of espionage TV with great performances. Season 2 is back. And when we begin, if you watch Season 1, you'll know it ended with a deadly explosion in the heart of London. And Kate Wyler, Kerry Russell's character, we don't know who's alive or dead. Bit of a spoiler here. Rufus Sewell, her husband, is clearly alive because you're about to hear me talk to him. So they're struggling to rebuild their lives. It carries the story of season 1 along. It turns out in season 2 that the attack, this warship, didn't come from a rival nation, but it came from inside the British government. So as she uncovers the truth, her only ally is her husband, Rufus Sewell, who is, as I say, very much alive. And she's rubbing against, and that's a interesting choice of words, the British Foreign Secretary, played by David Jesse, because they have a kind of frisson, let's say, but they also have a lot of work to do together between the US and the UK. Kerry Russell, of course, is star of The Americans, Felicity on TV. She was in movies like Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker, and recently Cocaine Bear. Brilliant actress, as is British actor Rufus Sewell, who was in everything from The Illusionist to, on TV, Middlemarch. I remember seeing him in, a great actor. So the two of them playing this unusual couple in The Diplomat season 2 spoke to me earlier in the week. Oh, and there's a little bad word in here that I'm not taking out because it's rather important. John Fardy from News Talk Radio in Dublin, Ireland. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too.
I'm a big fan of the show and I've urged people to watch it on this very show.
So Thank you very much.
Not at all. Kerry, one of the things I like about your character, and I'm wondering how you see her, is that she doesn't fall into any kind of stereotype that sometimes, unfortunately, women can be written into, like the needy career woman or the seemingly confident slash unstable woman. Like, she defies a lot of unpleasant stereotypes that can be in these kind of shows. But what's your take on that?
I just think Deborah Kahn, who is our show creator and writer, I just think she wrote a full person. You know, I think I love the messiness of Kate. I love the insecurities. I love how she's constantly spilling stuff on her clothes before she goes into the Oval Office. But I also think she's formidable. I think she's smart and she is an asset to a team and is very authentic as a person and has a complicated marriage. And I think all those things together make up a person. And it's just good writing. Like, Deborah is just really good. It's so fun to play. There's like a lot of contradictory good energy to her. And I think there was a time for us in TV about 10 years ago, for women especially, where there were a lot of women in power, but they weren't just a surgeon. They were the best surgeon you'd ever seen. And they were so funny. And you're like, that's boring. Like, who wants to see that? And it's not real, by the way, that everyone is all these good things. So I think that was a response to not enough women in TV or something. And now we're scaling it back. And I just think Deborah got the tone just right, for me anyway.
Yeah. She certainly did. Rufus, I've spoken to a few actors over the years who've had to keep secrets. You know, there's big ones, obviously, like Mark Hamill not saying he was Luke Skywalker or Darth Vader was his father.
Similar.
Our own Nicola Coughlin.
Very similar.
On another, on another Netflix show revealing certain stuff. But, you know, you're alive, clearly, right? Or else I wouldn't be talking to you. Was there I know non-disclosures and all that kind of stuff, but was it tricky around family and friends to go, I'm in the next season?
Luckily, I have family and friends who couldn't give a flying toss. So that was very much easier, like a mum, brothers, brother. They don't care.
I know.
They couldn't care less. It's very easy in my actual life.
Thanks for asking. Glad to hear it. Sorry, I thought it was a bigger thing, you know?
People ask me all the time. Yeah. People are like, who lived? Who died? Yeah. Who's going to? Yeah. I was like, what do you think?
Yeah, well, my brother is like, oh, that thing you did.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to watch it. I am. I watched the first couple of minutes. It looked good. I gave up.
Yeah. Your relationship in it, you know, you talked about the unusual writing and how it's real. Your relationship, your characters, is glorious because it's a marriage that may be coming apart or whatever. But at the same time, you know, Rufus smells your armpits to say if you need a shower. It's kind of beautiful in a weird kind of way. A lot of people talk to you about that? Because a lot of people mentioned it to me before I said I was going to talk to you.
Definitely. I mean, when we read it, it's not we even talked about it. We just got what it was.
Yeah.
And if we get what it was, I basically do this for myself and for people who like what I do. And if they don't, they watch something else.
Yeah.
I mean? And the people, there are certain people that love that. The people that are disgusted by it, okay, maybe there's another show for you. Do you know what I mean? But for us, it's like that's the key of the relationship.
It's so
what made
fun.
It identifiable.
And I think something we keep talking about when you're talking about kind of the intimacy of their relationship, and yes, the first season especially, there's a lot of friction in that energy. But I think no matter what, even if Hal and Kate were not together, even if they were with different people, I think the nature of this chemistry they have with each other, if they were with different people and they walked in the room, that energy would still be there. So I think whether they're fighting, whether they're in season two, it's very much a united front because of circumstances.
Whether there's a triangle.
That energy is there no matter what. And that's the fun and the of the show. What form that energy takes is up to the circumstances, but I think that is what the glue of this relationship is. It will always be there.
And whether also there is or isn't a triangle. That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. And also some of my favorite, like, screwball comedies are what they call, you know, like the comedy of divorce.
Yeah.
That actually there is a romance in that. Some of my favorite ones were always about people who are apart, but
should they really be together?
Know, and that can encompass new partners also. You know, that's
sure.
Who knows what can happen, you know?
Like when I have the crush on Dennison and you going, oh, you should fuck him while I'm gone. I can tell he's just your type. It's like, yeah. Then you've ruined the whole crush.
Exactly.
You don't want your husband
to say. You know who you should be with.
Yeah. Like, that just kills it.
It doesn't quite work, but I have a good go.
No one wants to hear that.
No.
Here's you should have sex.
Yeah, like.
Tell me. Sorry. Terrible of me to cut across you.
No, stop it. Stop it.
Our time is limited, Rufus, and I just had to ask you something. I had this mild epiphany last night. I was watching you, and in the first season, I thought, he reminds me of someone. And then I didn't really think about you again that much, because, you know, I have a busy life. And then it came to me last night. And forgive me if you've heard this a million times, but do people say to you, God, you remind me of Adam Ant a lot?
Good, no?
Yeah, that could be worse. I remember me and my brother, people used to say in the 80s that both of us, more my brother, but the adamant thing, was not an insult at a certain time.
I think that's cool.
No, I don't mean now. I'm
open to anything, but you know, I'm not. Listen, I've had worse.
Yeah.
Believe me.
Wonderful. Well, I'm sorry to end on Stand and Deliver, but the season 2 is great.
It's a great way to end. Thank you.
Continued thank you success, so much.
Guys.
Thank you. Right. Take
Thanks
care.
Very much.
Kerry Russell and Rufus Sewell there talking to me about season 2 of The Diplomat and their unusual relationship, and also how Rufus Sewell looks a bit like Adam Ant. After the break, the man who plays the British Foreign Secretary, David Jesse, talks to me about his role opposite Kerry Russell in the new season of The Diplomat. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks, TV and Movie Show. Take a little listen to this.
When you're blowing up your career, the outcome of which may be the end of an empire, you give it another day.
I've been giving it one more day since the day I took office. Eventually, if you want the serpent to die, you cut off its head.
Jesus Christ.
I've really got to get going. Thank you for stopping by.
Listen, I want you to come to Scotland with me and Kate and the Prime Minister. I want you to do it as a favor to me. Simply because I'm asking. And I think you're going to say yes.
You do?
Yes, I do. Because I know, and you know, that on the day I got blown up in the streets of your vaunted city, you were planning to f*** my wife.
See you in Scotland.
Looking forward to it.
Now, that is a clip there of Rufus Sewell, who you heard me talking to earlier in the break, opposite David Jesse, who plays British Foreign Secretary Austin Dennison in season 1 and season 2 of The Diplomat, which we were talking about before the break. He's brilliant in it as this seemingly decent politician, but, you know, who's also a politician at the end of the day and is following political expediency. And he has a strange relationship with the ambassador, Kerry Russell's character, and they are getting closer all the time. Now, I spoke to David Jesse, and I also spoke to the actress Ali-Ann, who you know from Orange is the New Black and things like that. She plays the CIA station chief in series 1 and indeed series 2, Idra Park. And she has her own issues going on. She's trying to keep the peace and keep America's interests at the heart of the British government and indeed the American government. She's also in a relationship with Stuart, who's part of the whole diplomatic team, and they have a pretty secretive, fractious relationship. And we're not even sure if Stuart is alive at the start of season 2, but we'll find out more when I speak to Ali-Ann, who plays Idra Park in season 2 of The Diplomat, and also David Jesse, who you might know from things like Interstellar, Cloud Atlas, brilliant British actor who plays the British Foreign Secretary, Austin Dennison. And I spoke to them earlier in the week.
Hi, guys. How are you? John Fardy from News Talk Radio in Dublin and Ireland.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Hey, John.
Nice to see you both. David, if I can start with you, you're an Englishman, I'm an Irishman. We've lots
we walked
of
into a pub. But, sorry, go on.
Yeah, I know, and an American lady walked in. Yeah. But I was thinking, you seem like a very modern British politician in it to me. Sharp suits, silver-tongued, that kind of thing. Now, as I say, you're talking to an Irish person, but I suppose what I'm asking is, do you see him as a good guy or a bad guy in the series?
How do you see him?
Probably somewhere in the middle. I don't think he's out to harm anyone, but I think, like a lot of politicians, political expediency is his modus operandi. But people want to hear from you, not me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so, like you said, modern politician, sharp suit, silver
tie. Best suits. He gets the most, like, tailored to a T.
They're great suits.
It's contractual.
They are great
suits. It's contractual.
Yeah. Listen, he knows what he's selling. Like,
it's what it is. I know why they pay me.
Tight vests, tight.
I think what has always been interesting about him and my relationship with him and Deborah, who writes it, is her interest in him bringing his background into his job as well. So the fact that he is the child of immigrant parents means that, you know, policy hits differently for him when these decisions are being made. And so that might be some of what you pick up with, is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? I think there's a level of integrity there, and maybe some of that can cost him in terms of ambition, and perhaps can cost him in terms of relationship and actually desire and want and all of those things. So that's probably why you read him as something in the middle, because we're not seeing the full colours and the entirety of him. Yeah,
sure. Ali, your relationship with Stuart is very interesting in it. And, you know, I don't think it's a spoiler because he's in the second series.
He's not dead. Yeah.
From the trailer. Yeah. And I was talking to Rufus earlier about keeping it secret. Yeah. Like, who's still alive or whatever?
Yeah.
But, you know, at the end of episode one, it's like, it's fine. She dumped me. It's a fascinating relationship you guys have. It's like, you know, covert they're going to be less covert about it. I think she's, you know, it's a show about politics. He's more into her than she is into him. But again, I'm wondering what your take on that is.
I think that Idra has never made space in her life for relationships. I think she is someone, she's like a, you know, a one night stand kind of girl. I think she is probably a little utilitarian in how she deals with men. And I think Stuart is actually someone that she does have feelings for. So to you, it may seem like Stuart's more into her, but that's just because for Idra, this is a lot. For Idra, she really likes this guy, but I think he throws her under the bus. I mean, he sort of puts his ambition before their relationship as far as she sees it at the end of the first season. So I think second season is tricky because her feelings are all still there, but he's shown her who he is, and she's smart enough to be like, well, he made his bed, so I guess we're moving on.
But it's a good way of putting it. You know, maybe she's only giving a little, but it's a lot for her, I guess. Yeah. I should say, by the way, I'm a big fan of the show. I was telling the guys earlier, I've recommended it on this radio station. So I've watched all of it. And
four episodes
of the new season. So just an FYI, in case you're wondering why I'm talking about suits and stuff like that. I paid it a lot of attention. But I was talking to Kerry beforehand, and I suppose, and Rufus called it, whether or not she's in a love triangle or not, your relationship with Kerry's character is fascinating, and there's clearly a frisson in it. And I wonder, you know, you hear about these things, chemistry tests in movies and stuff nowadays. Did you have to spend any time getting into that? Because sometimes you're so delightfully awkward with each other in it, and it's hard to guess what's going on. But was that instantaneous?
It's all natural, baby.
Do you work that up, you and Kerry?
So that's me trying to be slick and smooth and really just sail in there. So it's interesting.
For the record, he called it awkward.
It reads awkward.
For the it reads reading awkward.
I misread it.
But you have
the fault's with me, not you.
I think credit to Kerry, because we didn't have a chemistry test. And I think they obviously cast Kerry first. And just thought she's gonna work with whatever we throw at her.
She did make a joke to her friends where she sent them a picture of herself that had been snapped by paparazzi, like a particularly unflattering photo, and then she put it side by side with a photo of David's headshot, and she was like, somehow these two are supposed to be dating each other.
I didn't know that. I am incredibly flattered. Look, look, this is what we get to work with. It's incredible. It's lovely. Yeah. And they're lovely people as well.
They seem it. Ali, I was reading a bit about your career today, and one goes to Wikipedia.
Oh, God.
Whether you should or not.
I don't know what's on Wikipedia. Okay.
Well, here, let me tell you something. And I wonder how you take this, because I thought it was a weird thing to say about someone, but maybe it's a compliment. There was, you were in some off-Broadway production, and it said you raised the play you were in with your messy charisma.
Oh.
I thought it was a very interesting phrase that you could be flattered by, or you could be like, "Am I messy?"
I think
have you heard that before?
I think I know which play you're talking about because
it was about writing letters.
Yes, so letters. So that actually that is a compliment because that character, she is a mess. She's like kind of the opposite of Idra. She's doesn't really have a job. She was kind of stuck taking care of her parents, and so I'll take messy charisma as a compliment. I don't read reviews because I think if you take the good ones seriously, you have to take the bad ones seriously, and I think it can mess with you. So I try not to look at them, but I'll take messy charisma. I will take that. Yeah.
I love that.
If they had just said she's messy, if they're like she's on stage and she's messy, I would be like, oh,
no riz.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, look, you both just seem charismatic to me. Plain old-fashioned charismatic without any adjective. Lovely to talk to you and continued success in whatever you
Thank
do.
Thank you.
What a pleasure. Thank you.
David, Jesse and Ali Ann there talking to you about their roles in Season 2 of The Diplomat, which is on Netflix from the 31st of October. That's next Thursday. And fans of Diplomat Season 1 will be pleased to hear that Season 2 continues in a great vein, just like Season 1. After the break, we turn to the new cinema releases in the company of Chris Wasser. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. Now we were talking about TV before the break in the form of The Diplomat, so we better get to big screen releases in the cinema. I'm delighted to be joined by regular reviewer on this show, film critic and art journalist Chris Wasser, to take a look at a psychological horror called The Front Room, which I haven't seen, and a movie which I have seen, which is a genre-bending movie, to say the least, called Emilia Perez, starring Zoe Saldana and indeed Selena Gomez. Chris, how are you?
John, I'm very well. How are you?
Good. So let's start with The Front Room, a strange psychological horror of sorts, which may be a metaphor for mother-in-laws.
Yeah, you watch this film and you think to yourself, is it ever a good idea to live with in-laws? And it is. No, I would like to think that no one has ever had as bad a case as the one that comes up in this story. But even if you've never heard of this film before, if you haven't seen it yet, you might be familiar with the short story by Susan Hill, who obviously gave us the Woman in Black, and various stories of her have been adapted for the stage and the screen over the years. This one, I believe, having not read the original story, I think it kind of strays quite a bit from the original text. Sometimes that's not a bad thing. Sometimes that's a very risky thing. But here we have this contemporary setup where we've got this young married couple, Belinda, played by Brandy, and her husband Norman, played by Andrew Burnup. That's Brandy, actually, the singer and actress who goes by, you know, who has that single name status that we all kind of aspire to, John. Wouldn't that be great to just be known for one name? But they are a young married couple who are in a little bit of financial trouble. She has just quit her job as an anthropology professor. He hasn't yet secured a decent position at his law firm. You know, he's kind of one of those guys who's saying, I have to work late today and tomorrow and the next day, but soon everything will be all right. And you kind of think it won't be. But they have a baby on the way, so something needs to change. And when Norman's father dies, his elderly stepmother, Solange, played by Catherine Hunter, she phones up and she has a little proposition for this young couple. She says that if she can come and live with them now that she's by herself and live out the rest of her days, you know, because she's quite elderly, they can have all of her money. And there's a lot of money there, John. So despite the fact that Norman is clearly scarred by the time that he spent with his stepmother as a kid, he says that she was the worst. His wife says, look, she might not be with us that long. We have the space. We need the money. Let's let her move in. I don't think
what
I need to tell you what happens next. Oh, John, the tagline is something along the lines of, you know, all hell moves in. And that is, you know, it's fairly apt. I mean, we're not just talking about an overbearing mother-in-law here. We're talking about a real nasty piece of work, quite racist, doesn't approve of her stepson's wife, as soon as the baby is born, wants to be the one who's actually mothering her, just interferes all the time. And it's just a demon to live with, basically.
Yeah. And tell me this then. So when you say she's a demon to live with, and I don't want to give a spoiler, but it's safe to say there may be some paranormal dimension to her.
That's it. Yeah. Well, that's what I was thinking halfway through. But then when I was finished the film, I was none the wiser.
Okay.
It's based on a short story, a complete short story by Susan Hill. But we have Max and Sam Eggers, who are the younger twin brothers of Robert Eggers. Robert Eggers being the filmmaker who gave us The Witch, The Lighthouse, wonderful writer and director. And Max actually worked, he co-wrote The Lighthouse with
his
brother Robert. Great film, fantastic. Sorely overlooked a few years ago just because it was a bit too weird, but it was also great. And then Sam, the other brother, he worked as a crew member on The Witch. But the two of them have come together to adapt this story. And I just think they're just throwing ideas at us every few minutes and seeing what sticks. I don't think any of it really sticks. There are suggestions every now and then that there's some sort of supernatural element at play. You know, Solange is a devout Christian, but kind of takes, you know, her beliefs and her preaching a little bit too far. And there are suggestions every now and then, you know, something about like a scar from Belinda's pregnancy, for instance, that heals overnight. And you're thinking to yourself, because, you know, Solange touched her on the belly, and you're thinking to yourself, does this woman have some sort of supernatural powers? But the film then just forgets about that. And it just moves on to the next idea and the next. And some of those ideas are supernatural again, but some of them are quite ordinary. It's just, you know, about caring for a loved one after they move in, or why you shouldn't move in, or why you shouldn't live with your in-laws. It's all a bit muddled, basically.
Yeah. And I mean, the mother-in-law, the character, let's take a quick clip of, this is a clip of The Front Room.
I realized I do not know my granddaughter's name.
Oh, we're going to name her Fern.
Fern? Not a plant you got growing in there? No. It used to be parents understood names got to have power. How about a family name?
Well, my mother's name was Gertrude.
Gertrude? I thought you were supposed to have more interesting names.
What is that supposed to mean?
I'm not trying to be insulting.
No, I want to know what is a more interesting name?
Your father, what was his name?
Walter. But I didn't know him really well.
Call that a broken family.
Solange, would you please stop?
They were academics. My dad did not leave. He died after I was born.
I see. Thank you for educating me, and I apologize for any offense. But I am determined to give that child a proper name.
No. The mother-in-law there, very creepy sounding, but I'm assuming that doesn't elevate it.
Oh, no. And that gets annoying very quickly. The only thing here that comes close to a decent performance is Brandy's, you know, as the exasperated daughter-in-law who just can't quite believe that she's gotten herself into the situation, because she really only does, you know, between herself and her husband, they only have themselves to blame. But the rest of the film around her is just a mess. I think it's quite careless at times. It's quite crass. It just prioritizes these, you know, empty jump scares and really cheap, you know, low-hanging laughs over any sort of coherent storytelling. But it's the only thing it commits to, and this sounds weird, is this recurring bit about Solange's incontinence. And there's a lot of messy scenes, believe it at that, in this film. And it's as though the Eggers are kind of testing their audience and saying, look, how much crap can you take from us? And that is, there's a terrible pun in there, John. But they go way too far with it. It's just like, oh, well, that was effective last time. Let's do it again. No, that's not how storytelling works. That's not how horror works. So I found the whole thing just a little bit of a mess. It's just constant setup for 90 minutes and absolutely no payoff. The ending doesn't really make sense at all. I would like to know, again, I'm not overly familiar with the original short story. I'd love to know how far it strays from it. But this version is just, it's no good at all.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it doesn't translate. So what would you say stars-wise for The Front Room?
I think it's a film that promises everything but delivers nothing. So look, a star. It really was a depressing watch. I mean,
you don't have to explain.
We're coming up to Halloween. I want an effective horror, and this was just sadly ineffective.
This wasn't it. Okay, that's one star for The Front Room. He's speaking the truth, though. I should say, you know, you were saying, you know, oh, to be known by one name. In work, sometimes I get JF. Does that count? No?
Is that?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, it's not one name, but you know, at least it's not my full name. Be known by initials, I like. But anyway, let's not get into that now.
Yeah.
So listen, let's not get into that, CW. There is a fascinating movie, I thought, opening in cinemas this weekend. It will be on Netflix next month, but it's getting a cinema release, a decided cinema release, as in it's not just, you know, there for 2 days or whatever. It's getting a full cinema release. It was at the London Film Festival. I have seen it. Emilia Perez, a really strange movie.
It is a very strange movie and a fascinating one, is right. It's getting a 3-week cinema release. And I think that's a good thing because the folks at Netflix actually showed critics this film on the big screen. And I'm very happy that I saw it on the big screen because despite, you know, its problems, and there are a few, it's a huge film that deserves to be seen on the big screen possible. Now, it sounds a little bit odd. I mean, it is a bit of a melodrama, but it's also very much a musical. And it's about a Mexican cartel leader who basically hires an undervalued lawyer to help her fake her death. But there's more to it than that. And the truth is that this person named Juan Manitez Del Monte, played brilliantly by transgender actress Carla Sofia Gascon, she's decided to transition. She wants to live out the rest of her life. You know, she still is quite young, but she wants to live life as her true self, to be her authentic self in Mexico, to be known as Emilia Perez. But in order to make that transition, to do it successfully, I mean, she's, you know, quite a wanted woman. She'll need the best team that money can buy, and she'll need a good lawyer to help her find, you know, all the right doctors and all the right people to, you know, the right doctors to perform her surgery, but also the right people to put and plan a place for her to live a brand new life after the surgery. So that's where we have Rita, played just fantastically by Zoe Saldana. And again, she's this undervalued lawyer. You know, she's quickly, you know, she's kind of fast approaching 40, and she's never really been on a case. So she's been on plenty of cases, but she never really got the credit she deserves for all the work she did in those cases. But this might be her moment. So she sets out to find the right doctors, to find the right people to make this new life happen. But also for Emilia, starting a new life will mean leaving her wife, Jessie, played by Selena Gomez, and their two children behind. So Emilia is kind of telling herself and telling Rita, I'm ready for that heartache. But of course, John, I don't think anyone would be ready for that heartache. And after a few years, Rita is called back into the equation again. You know, it's two different stories here, but, and I don't think it's spoiling anything to say that a few years pass, surgery is successful, the new life is successful, but Emilia starts to miss her kids. And that's when things get really complicated.
Yeah, about an hour into it or so.
Yeah, yeah.
And I completely concur with you. Carla Sofia Gascon is just brilliant as the person who wants to be something very different to this hoodlum life. I saw this, and the day I was having, I didn't have a lot of time to read up about what I was going to see, but I was going to see it because in a few weeks you'll hear my interview with Selena Gomez and Zoe Saldana. And like, so I sat down not knowing what it was, and the genre bendingness of it I just found fascinating, because it's a drug story, it's a story about gender politics, it's a musical, it's a drama. Like, I found this wildly affecting, I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, there's an awful lot going on in here, and I was going to say, here we are telling you what this film is like and what we thought of it, but I'll also say that maybe this is the kind of film that you are better off going into blind, you know, and knowing as little about it as possible. I think sensational performances make a world of difference here. And this was a big winner at Cannes earlier on in the year, but it was a big winner for the actresses, where I think three or four of the main actresses here shared the Best Actress prize. And so that'd be interesting now going into award season, where at least two names from this film will definitely dominate, you know, award season conversations in terms of the actress categories. But it'd be interesting to see which two of those are, because there's a lot of great performances in here. It is quite audacious, but it's a Jacques Audiard film, so you know, you kind of know what
who gave us Prophet, which is a fantastic film.
Yeah, and he's a filmmaker that isn't afraid to, you know, take risks and to try something new. I think the plot is a little bit loose, and the musical numbers don't always work. And I think it kind of needs the musical numbers to fill in quite a few plot holes. And it's kind of as if at times it's distracting us with this big song and dance show, because if you start to think too much about, you know, well, hold on a second, you know, how exactly is Emilia planning that life for herself, and why does she need Rita all those years later to help her do something that kind of seems reasonably simple? You know, it doesn't matter. Here's another song. But it's not, we're not talking about, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein sort of stuff here. We're talking more in the sort of Lin-Manuel Miranda sort of, you know, that those big chewy worthy numbers where you're like, it doesn't matter if you didn't get all the lyrics first time around, we can watch it a second or a third time and you can still sort of follow it. I think the two star performers for me, although I did love Selena Gomez in this, I mean, between this and Only Murders in the Building, I think she's having a great time on screen at the minute. But Carla Sofia Gascon, wonderful. It really is. And I mean, she's probably in line now to become the first transgender performer to be nominated for an Oscar, and it'll be thoroughly deserved. And Zoe Saldana, who is an actor that, I mean, she's part of two of the biggest franchises of all time, you know, her role as Gamora in Marvel, and obviously she's part of Avatar. And sometimes it's all too easy to kind of see her just in those roles, just as this blockbuster queen. And we forget, you know, at least I've forgotten sometimes, she's a wonderful actor. And I think this showcases that more than any role that she's ever had. So it's definitely uneven, definitely wobbly. Sometimes the musical numbers sort of are a little bit jarring with some of the more serious subject matter, but I'm glad I watched it.
Yeah, you see, it's funny, plot holes. I didn't see one only because I mustn't have noticed them, because the musical numbers, what I liked about them, came out of nowhere and kind of whacked you on the head, which I found to be very kind of pleasing. But whatever about plot holes, and I'd have to think back on it because it's a couple of weeks since I saw it, to be honest with you. But there were certain plot moments that I was really loved. Like, for instance, when Carla Sofia Gascon's character, after she's transitioned, meets Zoe Saldana in London without giving a spoiler. I thought that was brilliant. And that really stayed with me, that kind of reveal moment. We are getting close to spoiler territory. And there was a few more moments like that as well. So whatever plot holes may or may not have been in it, they didn't affect me. And I don't generally, I love movies, I love music, but musicals a lot of the time don't do it for me. But yet, I these ones really did. So I kind of love this for its ambition and its, you know, Immanuel Kant once said, to get very deep, that David Hume, the philosopher, woke him from his dogmatic slumber. I found this woke me from some kind of cinematic slumber. I just thought, wow, what the hell is this? And I watched it rapt from start to finish. So there you go. Yeah.
I totally agree. I mean, whatever problems I have with it, if you're not a little bit excited or committed to this performance or did this film while you're watching it, then you might be dead inside. You know, like it does it does stir something in you. And I agree. Look, that musical number at the dinner table, beautiful. There's another performance where Zoe Saldana's character Rita is. I think Amelia is giving some sort of speech. There's this big award ceremony, and she gets up and she starts performing in and around the tables, and it's just beautiful to look at. The song is wonderful, the performance. But then you've got little musical numbers where Rita is sitting with the doctor who perform Amelia's surgery, and they're talking about something so serious, and next of all they just break in the song. And I think in cases like that, I found that just a little bit clunky. So yeah, look, again, and just going back to a performer we haven't mentioned much in this review, Selena Gomez. I know you interviewed her and we'll be listening to that in a few weeks. She is really terrific here. And again, I think she's another performer who is sometimes, I mean, you think of great, you know, actresses at the minute, and she's not near the top of that list. She should be. She is quite effective here.
Absolutely. And sorry I name dropped Selena Gomez, but you see, the thing is, the reason why it looms large in my head, my middle child is a girl aged 9 years of age and has remained thoroughly and defiantly unimpressed by any famous people I've spoken to in previous years. However, she did say to me, Selena Gomez, why is she talking to you? Which, you know, I just think I'm going to get made up and put in a t-shirt. Okay, so what are you going to say stars-wise for Amelia Perez?
We don't usually do half stars, but we will for that. We'll say 3.5 stars for Amelia Perez. Because I think, you know, some people hear the 3-star rating and they go, well, you know, it must not be great. No, there are problems with it, but it is certainly worth your time. And if you are going to watch it, try and catch it in the cinema, I think. Mm-hmm. It deserves to be seen on that big screen. And I do think we'll be talking about this in a couple of months when award season kicks off.
Definitely. Now, I agree with you in terms of seeing it on a big screen. Absolutely. Watch it in the dark on a big screen. I give it 4 stars because I really loved it. And I went in not knowing what it was about. So it's 4 stars for me. It's 3.5
for Chris Wasser, but we're both saying go and watch it, and certainly watch it ahead of The Front Room. Now, Chris, there is a big new movie release this week, Venom's Last Dance, right? Neither of us have seen it. It is being shown to film critics on Thursday evening, the night before it opens, which can only lead me to believe it's as crap as all the other ones that have come before it. Maybe I'm being a little indelicate or unkind to it, but what's your sense of it?
I think those late in the day screenings, they are a little bit worrying. And look, we'll watch the film before we cast any sort of judgment on it. But going by the other two, I'm not confident I'll have a good time with this. And it's so funny because the Venom films, you never really hear people talking about them. Not, you know, outside, you know, the run up to whatever sequel we get with Tom Hardy. Like, you know, no one ever turns around and says, you know what, superhero films are great, Venom. And despite that, they've made a small fortune, a sizable fortune for Sony, yeah. Because Sony still have the rights to all of these various different, you know, Spider-Man offshoots and all of his villain characters. And they're kind of setting up their own little Spider-Man universe in conjunction with whatever they're doing, with whatever Marvel Studios are doing. But most of those, you know, other Spider-Man films like Morbius and Madame Web or Madame Web, like they've all just tanked and they've been, yeah. they performed so poorly with critics and also with audiences. The only one that hasn't performed poorly with audiences is Venom. So, and I don't know whether that's the Tom Hardy effect, but they've made a fortune. Are they any good? They're not. They're really not. They're quite sloppy. They're just story. The storytelling is never really, you know, the stories are not great in them. It's all about, you know, oh, what can we get? It's all about the relationship between, you know, the extraterrestrial and Tom Hardy's Eddie Brock. I mean, they don't really develop it anything beyond this weird buddy comedy between an alien and a journalist. It's very, very strange, very, very sloppy. Yeah. Have you seen them yourself?
Oh, I remember seeing the first one and thinking very little of it. And it just seems an exercise in, you know, continuing the Spider-Man universe.
Yeah.
So look, we haven't seen it though. So we can claim it could be the greatest thing since sliced bread.
If
I was a betting man or woman, I would probably bet against it being the greatest thing since sliced bread. But it is released in cinemas this Friday, the 25th of October, Venom's Last Dance. Chris has seen Emilia Perez, which he gave 3.5 stars to. I gave it 4. And he saw The Front Room, which he gave a lowly 1 stars to. So the movie of the week, unquestionably to see in a cinema, is Emilia Perez. Chris, thanks a million.
Thanks a million, John.
Chris Wasser there, reviewing the week's new cinema releases. That's it for this week. Next week on the show, I'm going to be talking to Christopher Reeve's children about the fantastic new documentary all about his life called Superman, the Christopher Reeve story. Also, I'm going to be talking to great Enda Walsh, yes, playwright and film writer, about the new movie Small Things Like These, starring Cillian Murphy, based on the novel by Claire Keegan. So all of that to come next week. In the meantime, I'll just remind you this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend. Have a nice bank holiday, and I will talk to you all next week.
Screen Time with John Fardy.
Thanks to Airtainment.
Saturdays at 6 p.m. on News Talk.